You're listening to the Bon Appetit Foodcast. I'm Adam Rappaport. This week, we're talking all about cookies, because every year, one lucky person at Bon Appetit, actually, I'm not even sure if it's lucky. It's a very tough assignment, but one editor gets to develop all of the holiday cookies for our December issue. And they have to be not only delicious, but they got to be beautiful, they got to be makeable, they got to be packable. It's a tall order, but this year, Rick Sugarman Martinez, named for his deep love of all things dessert, stepped up to that challenge. So I talked to Rick about how he conceived his cookies, how he made them, and I asked for some tips so you can make them at home. And after that, associate editor Alex Delaney is back to tell us which three cocktails we should be drinking now that winter has officially hit. And then finally, we have Alex Beggs with the latest installment of Cook, Marry, Kill. Before we get to the show, I just want to let you know we're now doing kind of like a monthly mailbag segment. Did one last month, have another one coming out in a couple weeks. If you have any questions, hit us up about how we do what we do, anything and all things Bon Appetit. You can email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. All right, here is Rick Martinez. Rick Martinez, have you ever actually won a cookie swap?
Actually, last year, yeah. I struggled a lot because the people that were hosting the swap wanted to make a lot of my cookie recipes from other years. So I couldn't actually make any of my own previous cookie recipes.
Wow. So it's like Taylor Swift or something, and she loses her publishing rights.
Yeah.
Wow.
So I actually had to invent a new cookie recipe specifically for that swap. But I did a kind of a cross between a fudgy whoopie pie with like a homemade orange marshmallow situation sandwich cookie.
Oh, wow. That sounds delicious.
Yeah.
It looks cool. What did you name it?
Basically, it was the hot chocolate orange sandwich cookie. Yeah.
Okay. I'm excited about that. So you did the cover story for our December issue called Win the Cookie Swap. You collaborated with Hillary Cadigan, the writer-editor, about a very sort of honest way to sort of like, you know what? It actually is competitive. When you show up, like you want to bring it, and here's how to do it.
Yeah. It's a lot. Like, you know, especially when you go to these cookie swaps now, because people are pulling from old issues, they're really upping their game, and they're very judgy too. Like, there were some people that walked in with boxes of cookies that they had bought.
What?
Yeah. And I mean, they were literally laughed right out of the house.
I hope so.
Yeah.
I've never gone to a cookie swap, I hate to say. Is there like a voting process, or like how is it decided who actually wins?
Some are coordinated. Some, like I've been to places where they'll lay literally like butcher paper out, and people will write comments. You put your cookies down, you put your name,
yeah.
Write the name.
Oh, I've actually been to a pie exchange like that one time.
Right. And people will, you know, write comments on the side, or write stars, or like indicate, you know, some kind of a rating. Or other times, at the end of the night, whatever cookies are completely gone are the winners. And then, of course, you have all the ones that nobody ate, and those are obviously the losers. So it's pretty competitive.
All right, so for the December issue, you developed six different cookies, three of which appear on, we have a tri-cover situation this month, three different covers. Before we get started on the specific cookies, what was your sort of guiding ethos in terms of developing these cookies?
I love cookies. Yeah. My nickname in the kitchen is Sugar Man for a reason. So I always start with, what do I actually want to eat? So all of these cookies came from a place of like, what do I want to eat? And then how do you then take them to a place where they're going to win a swap? Because, you know, I knew that the flavors going in were going to be pretty outstanding, but they also had to look phenomenal.
As you know, being on the development side of recipes at a place like Bon Appetit, like, the photo editor, the creative director, everyone's going to have an opinion. Like, is it attractive enough? Is it bold enough? Can it hold the cover? Like, you have to bring those visuals up to the tippy top in order to sort of earn a cover.
Right. And I actually had this visual in my head. There was a night, this is probably in 2016. Claire was doing the cookie story, and we were both working late, and I saw her at her desk, like literally sketching out the cookies.
Ooh.
And I knew that she started from a place of like, what were they going to look like? And what were they going to look like together? And for me, I started from the flavor and then like, how do I make them just like pop? And so it was kind of a different way of thinking about it. But I actually, to me, that was a big challenge because I knew what flavor I wanted going yeah. into the whole thing. For me, that was like, okay, so now how can I make a mole cookie look good?
Yeah. You know, that's interesting. I've always, like, as a visual first editor, mm-hmm. I see what the page is going to look like or what the story should look like and how it should be packaged. Other editors are much more like they just worry about the words and, mm-hmm. and whatnot, and then they'll figure out the visuals on the back end. There's two ways to approach it, and I think neither is superior to the other, but there's just, yeah, you kind of have to know which way you think. All right, so I want to talk about some specific cookies. I'm just going to go with my favorite.
Okay.
One of the cover stars, I love the look of this, but the flavor blew my mind when I tasted it because the green is due to fresh mint.
Fresh mint.
Talk to me about this.
So this was, you know, like, again, starting from the flavor profile, like, I love Thin Mints, and a lot of my friends love Thin Mints. And I also really like the idea of a black and white cookie, even though I don't actually like black and white cookies.
They're not really cookies. They're more like cake.
Cakes, yeah, right, exactly.
They're cakeys.
Yeah, and it's just, and also I always feel like the icing never has any flavor. It's just like this weird.
Waxy.
Yeah, they're kind of gross. But I like the visual of it. Yeah. I think they can be really striking.
The symmetry.
Yeah, and like when you have a really tight line. And so I kind of just liked the idea of putting those things together. And I knew that I needed a green color. I didn't want to use mint extract. I didn't want to use dried mint because that would kind of turn it gray. And I thought, you know, I wonder if I could get away with using fresh mint. And it's green. Like, you know, I was thinking like pestos. What if yeah. I made kind of like a minty butter situation? And I remember the first time I did it, Molly was across from me and she looked at me and she was like, ugh, kind of gave me a little side eye and a roll. Like, that's going to turn black when you bake it. And
because you've always seen, like, when you have mint in the fridge and if you don't use it, and it,
right.
yeah, it turns dark and like right. shriveled and bleh.
Right. And, but I thought, okay, well, you make pesto, right, in a food processor, and it's the oil that prevents the herb mm-hmm. from turning black. So I thought, okay, well, if I can make a mint butter and then use the mint butter to make the cookie. And then I thought, okay, well, I don't want to use two machines. I don't want to make the mint butter in a food processor and then transfer it to a mixer. So I'm like, I'm just going to make the whole cookie in a food processor. And so I just kind of threw it together. And the first batch, I was like, it stayed green.
And is it basically kind of like a mint butter cookie?
It's a mint butter cookie, yeah. Exactly what it is.
I remember I came around the test kitchen one of those first days you're doing it. And I was like, oh, what's that? And I tasted it. And I was like, oh my God, this, not only is it this beautiful, natural green, but it tasted like fresh mint.
Like fresh mint.
And it kind of blew my mind.
Yeah, I was super happy when that first batch, when you did come over, I was like, this was pretty amazing. Like, the texture wasn't quite right, but I knew I could get the texture down. It was preserving the flavor and the color. That yeah. was the big part. And it took a lot of mint. I mean, it takes like a big, like yeah. 2 cups of mint. But
that's not, but then the big, you know, in the big picture, that's not that much. So, no. All right, so you nailed the cookie. Then you're like, all right, how do I make this look visually appealing enough to put on the cover of a magazine?
Right. And originally I was going to do like the icings, and I thought about, I'd crystallized some mint leaves, and I thought about like kind of decorating it that way. And it just got overly complicated. And I thought, okay, you know what? Let's play up the black and white part and then just show off some of the green. Just open it up. Like, don't completely close them in. And that's kind of how those little slices or the thirds came in.
So you have a third dipped in dark chocolate, like clean line going across, and yeah. then on a sort of an angle you have, is you're dipping it in, what is that, crystallized sugar or something?
So that's just sanding sugar, white
sanding sugar. Okay.
Yeah. So actually when you bake it, you punch out the round, and then I used a bench scraper, mm-hmm. so you have a nice clean line, and then you just sprinkle the sugar on one side.
Okay.
Bake it with the sugar. When it cools off, then you dip it in the chocolate.
Yeah, and you have a kind of a third. So a third sugar, a third green cookie, a third chocolate.
Yeah.
And like you said, you get that awesome Girl Scout cookie chocolate mint flavor, visually appealing, fresh mint that we've never had before. And I feel like this is one of those cookies, like, you're like, oh, this feels new, but the flavors are still so familiar.
Right, right.
Give me your three essential cookie baking tools that every home baker should own.
If you make a lot of cookies, you absolutely have to have ice cream scoops.
See, I love this.
I have three at home, big, medium, small, depending on what I'm making.
Oh, that's interesting. So in case you want like a big chocolate chip cookie versus, okay.
So if I'm making my the brown butter toffee cookies, I want those to be big so that those get the big scoops. A normal, you know, butter cookie or a peanut butter cookie, those like get a little smaller. If I'm doing cookies for a crowd, I want them very small.
And these are the scoops that have the little thumb sort of spring mechanism to
and it scoops
eject
out,
them.
Yeah, and it scoops out the, it cleans out the scoop for you. Yeah.
And so this way you can have every cookie be essentially the exact same size.
Yeah. So this is what professional bakers use. A, you get a perfect circle each time. So the cookie will spread beautifully. They're exactly the same size. Also, I mean, they're great for meatballs.
Totally. All right. I love that. And ice cream.
And ice cream.
You got two more essential tools.
If you do a lot of baking at all, you need an oven thermometer. Everybody's ovens are different. We have, 12 ovens downstairs or upstairs, and each oven is different. So you absolutely need an oven thermometer. If you have the money or you do a lot of baking, I have a digital thermometer. Those are great. It's accurate. You put it in there. You know exactly, what.
Is that the type that stays in there, then it has the cord that goes out to the reader on the counter?
Exactly. And a lot of them, they do double duty. So if you get, it'll double as both an oven thermometer, but also like a probe thermometer. Yeah. So you can stick it in a roast for Christmas.
How much of a difference will you notice between like the bottom rack in your oven and the top rack?
A lot. Yeah. Because if the heating element is on the bottom of the oven, so the bottom is always going to be hotter. You're getting just, intense heat. It's radiating upwards. So for example, if you cook if you bake your cookies on the bottom rack, the bottom of the cookie are going to brown or even burn after 12 minutes. Whereas the top is going to be a lot cooler. So if you bake them on the top, then the bottom of the cookie is going to stay blonde. The tops of the cookies are going to brown a little bit faster.
If you're doing two sheet pans of cookies, will you rotate them?
Yeah.
Okay.
If you're trying to go a little quicker and you're doing two sheets at a time, you always want your two racks in the lower and the upper thirds of your oven, and then bake them for about 5 minutes and then rotate, because heat always rises. So
I've heard that before.
Yes. So on the bottom rack, the bottom of the cookie will brown faster. On the top rack, the top of the cookie is going to brown faster.
All right, third tool.
I love parchment paper.
Yeah.
Parchment paper, it's, A, nothing will stick to it.
Literally.
Like even when your sugar falls off the cookie and caramelizes on the bottom, it will not stick to the parchment. And what is also great is that you don't have to clean your cookie sheet.
Yeah, the pan stays clean.
This pan stays
clean. Let me ask you a question. Do you buy the parchment paper that comes in sheets, or do you buy the parchment paper that comes in a roll that you then tear off?
At the grocery store, it's just in the roll. Yeah. So, I mean, it's slightly annoying. But
those sheets are pretty cool.
They're pretty cool. Yeah. And actually, I reuse them.
Look at you.
Yeah, I mean, because the cookies are just leaving a little trail of butter on the on the parchment. So,
Big whoop.
Yeah, exactly. So, make several batches of cookies, use the same piece of paper.
All right, next cookie. I would say this is the one I was most intrigued by, and I want to say maybe, I don't say give you a hard time, but I was challenging you on this one.
I was convinced this cookie was going to die.
Alfajores?
Alfajores, sí.
With coconut dulce de leche.
Yes.
Talk to me about these in the chat. How would you describe them to the listener, and then the challenges you faced?
So it's a traditional Spanish and Latin American cookie. The Spanish brought a version of it over to a lot of the countries that they were occupying. This particular one is based off of an Argentinian style recipe. Basically, it's a honey almond shortbread cookie that has a dulce de leche. And a lot of times the sides of the cookies are rolled in shredded coconut.
But this is a sandwich cookie with dulce de leche in the middle.
In the middle, yeah. And what I thought is, okay, the only coconut in this cookie is the one that's decorating the edge of the sandwich. And I thought, if I'm going to put coconut in something, I want to taste. Yes. I want it to be present.
Yeah, why not?
So I thought, I'm going to make an easy coconut dulce de leche. That sounded really delicious to me. So, and it's super easy. Can of coconut milk, can of sweetened condensed milk, you bake it for an hour and then whip it up.
When you say bake it, what do you mean?
Put it in a Pyrex baking sheet, literally just whisk them together, bake it.
Oh, really? Just in the oven, not
in
the
oven.
Stovetop.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So you don't even have to like stand over it and watch it. You have to stir it a couple of times, and then it's going to look really horrible and broken when it comes out of the oven. You put it in the food processor, and it turns into smooth, creamy dulce de leche.
That's so cool. Yeah. So you have this coconut caramel, essentially.
Essentially, yeah.
Then you make your cookies, round cookies.
Yep.
And then you've got the decorative element on top. So talk to me about that.
So, like I said, usually the coconut's on the side. I thought, I want to put it on the top, and I also want to make it more festive. And so one of the cool products that I really love and I used in a couple of different cookies in this package is these natural food dyes. I didn't want to use anything, you know, like kind of the Thin Mint. I didn't want to use extracts. I didn't want to use any kind of dyes. I don't know what any of those chemicals are. I want to taste decorative elements. So I found these really cool dried fruit powders, and they looked cool. They were bright and vibrant. They had texture. They had flavor. And so I thought, okay, I'm gonna toss the coconut in these fruit powders, give them a little color, maybe throw some glitter, something sparkly on them.
What kind of coconut did you start off with?
Dry, shredded, so unsweetened.
Yep.
You want to find a grade as possible on the coconut because you know, the larger flakes aren't going to look as good on a small cookie. Yeah, I was really, really excited. And you take a little bit of honey, which is also in the cookie. You brush it on top when the cookie comes out of the oven, and then sprinkle the colored coconut on top. And I thought it gave it a really, really festive, fun look.
Which colors worked best?
Definitely this one. This is the dragon fruit powder.
Ooh.
Yeah. Which I liked a lot, and we also used it in the tie-dye cookie.
And that's kind of like a hot fuchsia pink.
It's a really hot fuchsia pink, yeah. And I think in the original version that I had done, this is where I was convinced that you were going to cut this cookie. I had cut a hole in the top cookie so you could see the dulce de leche coming through. And I think that was kind of like a little off-putting.
There was something about it, I remember it was because we didn't get enough of the coconut, or there was something going on. And then you also had the bluish-gray...
Yeah, butterfly pea.
Butterfly, that did not work as a natural dye. I think the natural dyes are really interesting and very of the moment. Some definitely power through better than others in terms of like bringing color.
Yeah. This one, the dragon fruit, I think, is just such an amazing color.
Yeah, no, it's very cool. And you got that dulce de leche oozing out of the sides.
Yeah.
This one I want to eat immediately. Also, what's your biggest holiday cookie fail that you've had?
I was visiting friends, and we had had a dinner, and they didn't plan for any desserts or any cookies. And so they looked at me and said, "All right, Rick, I think you should bake some cookies."
You're like,
okay. So I scrounged. They had everything for some cookies. I made the dough and threw them in the oven. They had a very warped baking sheet.
I had one the other day. I was using it, and at some point it became it's newish, has become kind of convex.
Right.
So it slopes down, and I don't know how this happened, but when you're trying to roast potatoes and stuff, does not roast evenly. Things go to the side.
Right.
Not good.
And I don't know why it didn't even occur to me that this was going to be an issue. So they even had parchment paper. So I put the parchment paper down, put all my cookies. They were all evenly spaced, put them in the oven, set my timer. I opened the oven door and they had literally all slid into the center and created one giant sort of amoeba looking cookie.
I bet it still tasted all right.
I mean, it still tasted all right, but yeah. But
it was not as pretty as, I'm sure, your third cover star, the tie-dye butter cookie.
Ah, yes. That I was very, very happy with. And it took me a long time to get this cookie right, actually, the cookie part of it.
See, that's interesting, because I would assume the cookie part was the most basic part, because it looks like a butter cookie with this cool, swirly, psychedelic tie-dye icing on top. But what was the challenge with the cookie?
Well, the icing or the decorating was going to take time. So I wanted to have a really simple cookie because I feel like if, you know, you can only ask someone to do one thing. Either you make a complicated cookie and then don't decorate it, or you make a simple cookie that's then decorated. And the problem with most cookies that you have to roll out and cut, you have to make the dough and then let it rest or chill it. And I really wanted to just be able to make a dough, roll it, cut it, bake it. And that's that.
Yeah, sounds good.
And you just, it, in order to do that, you have to have the right ratios of fat and flour and sugar. And so getting that right, so it was sturdy enough to hold an icing, sturdy enough to be able to just put it in a mixer, then pat it down, roll it, and cut it. That took a while to get right. But then once I got that right, then to me, the icing part was like pretty simple. You know, you're just kind of like channeling your inner artist, making little swirly patterns on a plate or a saucer and dipping the cookie in.
So explain that to me. So you have your butter cookie, then you're making a glaze with multiple colors. I don't understand. How does this work?
So basically you're making a really simple icing that's powdered sugar and water and a little bit of the dried dyes. You just take a plate, put a teaspoon down of, you know, whatever colors you like, then add a little more to that, and then kind of swirl it in. You want to kind of make that tie-dye pattern on the plate.
Oh, before you dip the cookie.
Before you dip the cookie.
Oh.
And then you dip the cookie, and then you basically transfer that
and
pattern.
Okay. So I thought you... All right. That makes sense then. All right.
Yeah.
So, and you just do it with like a toothpick? You sort of swirl
right,
about?
Right. And because what I found is when you try and decorate on the cookie... A, you get too much icing, I think.
Yeah.
And I don't like really overly iced cookies. I think they're gross.
Goes back to the black and white cookie.
Right, exactly. And so I wanted a thin glaze, but I wanted that pattern. And also the other problem is that, you know, if you try and decorate on the cookie, like if you screw it up, you're kind of, you've just lost a cookie. This way, if you don't like the pattern that's on your plate, you just wipe it off, start over again.
So the ones we shot have like that fuchsia, the dragon fruit,
yep.
correct? White. And like blue. I mean, some of these shots, it almost looks like you're looking at like the Earth
planet,
from like the moon. Like there's something very psychedelic but global about it.
Yeah.
And it's like very trippy.
Yeah. And I think that's another thing about these natural dyes is that they're ground, you know, so you can see little flecks of the fruit or the herb or
gives
whatever
it texture.
Was. Yeah. And I think it just makes it very natural and very of the moment.
Are you a guy who gifts cookies?
Not really, no.
Not really.
No. I take cookies to you know, swaps and parties.
Any
and
advice
like that.
On transporting cookies?
Yes. So my normal go-to method for just a standard, like a chocolate chip or something that's not necessarily decorated, mm-hmm. would be just a standard deli soup container.
Okay, like a quart
container.
And stack them up.
Yeah, so you just like do a stack. I use them all the time. I use them for cupcakes. I use them for you know, muffins, for cookies. They're great transporting devices. For the decorated cookies, something that you want to lay flat so that they're not stacked on top of each other that would ruin the decoration. I've gone to bakeries and just like begged for a cake box or a pizza box is great.
Pizza box is good.
Not a used one, but just go to your.
So if you have a pizzeria, you can literally buy a box for a buck.
Exactly. Yeah, or just trade them cookies. Like I'll give you here's six cookies. Give me a box.
Yeah.
And those work great. If you do this a lot, if you're a really hardcore cookie swap person, there is a really cool, it's like a little suitcase that has a shelving
no
system.
No way.
In it. Yeah. So you can basically just slip all your cookies in. They're in nice little shelves. Nothing gets damaged. They're completely protected. Yeah.
I can imagine there's nothing more deflating than spending all this time on a cookie and then getting to the swap and open the box and all the icings have been
it's
smushed
horrible.
Together.
Yeah, exactly.
You've lost before
you
even started.
You have completely lost. You just go home.
God. These are probably the most sort of interesting and least, I don't know, like, I don't know if I would say least obvious cookies in terms of holiday cookies. But the ancho mole cookies, just visually, that before we even get into the flavor profile, just what they look like and how these guys came together.
So someone on Instagram had DM'd me a shot of a mole cookie from a bakery here in the U.S.
And what did it look like?
I mean, it kind of looked like how you'd expect it, just a brown blob.
Yeah.
And I was intrigued by the idea of it, but visually it just looked horrible. And I think, you know, like the actual dish, you can, you know, add toppings to it and make it visually interesting. But as a cookie, it just seemed, it was not appealing to me at all. But I like the idea.
But something piqued your curiosity about, ooh, mole cookie. Yeah.
It was a challenge. Like I can imagine all of those flavors being really good in a cookie situation. But, you know, how do you make that visually interesting? And then I was at Fire Island. It was really late at night. I was thinking about the cookies and my buddy had to work late. He was working on an advertising new business pitch. And so we're sitting at the table and I was like, what if I did a mole slice and bake? And he's like, what? I'm like, no. Like,
hear me out.
Yeah. So like, all of the same ingredients that are in mole, but in their whole form.
But moles have like 28 ingredients. So right, what? So right. What did that mean to you? What ingredients meaning what?
So yeah, certainly not all of them, but the main flavor profiles are the seeds, the nuts, the chocolate, the fruit, and the chili. Right. So I thought, okay, so that's five things. Then I just like add flour and sugar and butter.
And toss it all together in their whole form.
Right, right. So I really like that idea. I like the idea of being able to see all of the ingredients. And then I made one version, or the first pass at this, when I looked at it, it actually reminded me, if you've been to the pyramids in Mexico, the grout that the Aztecs used actually looks very similar to that. And like, there's like little bitty stones and like different size stones.
This one is, so they're kind of triangular shaped and they have it almost stained glass quality because you have like the dried papaya or mango, which is orange, and then the pieces of chocolate, which are obviously chocolate colored, and the nuts, and it's all, they're kind of suspended.
Yeah, and so when I got that, you know, I looked at it and I thought, this reminds me of the pyramid. I thought, okay, well, obviously this needs to be a triangle shape. Which a slice and bake is easy because
that's how the triangle came about.
Yeah. So you literally just slap the dough log down three times on each side and it becomes a triangle. So I was like, all right, it's an easy way of like making a unique shape.
So amazing when an idea comes together, you're like, oh, I got it.
Yeah. Yeah.
The quintessential elements of a mole sort of broken down, reassembled. The cookie itself for the dough, of which all these elements are suspended, what is the flavor profile of the cookie itself?
It's basically an ancho agave cookie. Okay. So there's a little bit of agave syrup in there for flavor and to soften it up a little bit. And then ancho powder. There's actually I think it's a quarter cup of ancho powder in there.
And so what does that do for the flavor profile?
It gives you that kind of nice like reddish brown color, but it also adds a little bit of heat at the end.
So you do kind of taste a little something.
Yeah, yeah. In my mind, to be called a mole, you do need a little bit of a kick, a little spiciness at the end. So, yeah. It kind of reads like a warm cinnamon kind of finish.
Mm. What's the most overrated holiday cookie?
I think gingerbread. I like ginger cookies a lot, but I feel like, you know, the hard, like kind of cardboardy ginger cookies that people decorate, like...
Eh. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I don't want to eat that.
My sister gets very into doing that with my son, who's now a little bit too old for that, but doing the whole gingerbread house sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That you spend all day doing, and then no one actually eats. You're like, yeah, I'm good.
Right. But I love ginger molasses as a flavor, as a cookie. Yeah. I think that's it's such a great combo.
If done well.
If done well.
Okay, so there was this one cookie. There was debate. I'm like, is that a cookie, or is it like a skillet pie dessert thing, or like what is going on here? I'm talking about the butter pecan skillet cookies that I'm still not sure if it's cookie, but it's already in the magazine, so I can't rescind it now. Took a good photo. It looks cool. Talk to me about this. What was the inspiration for this?
So again, this was, you know, going back to trying to make this easy for the reader, right? There's some cookies in here that are a little bit harder than others. I feel like skillet cookies are such an easy cookie to make because you don't have to roll out the dough, right? You don't need a special sheet pan. You just need a skillet.
That's a good point. So you don't need your scoops or bench scrapers or
nothing,
any of that stuff.
Right. And I also, you know, from a visual perspective, the other thing that I like about this is it's a very different shape, you know, altogether.
Because when you slice it, you're slicing it into pizza slices, basically. Yeah,
exactly.
Triangles, where everything else is round.
Right.
For the most
part. So that was from the onset, I knew I wanted a skillet cookie of some type.
Okay.
Because it was easy and because it would give me a different shape than, you know, all the circles that were going to be in the rest of the package.
You know what kids love?
What?
When you're on vacation, they love the cowboy cookie that's in the skillet, comes to the table hot with a scoop of ice cream in the middle.
Yeah.
It's pretty good.
Yeah. Well, and funny that you brought up ice cream because the flavor profile is basically like a love letter to butter pecan ice cream. I like that flavor a lot. All my friends love this flavor.
That was my dad's favorite ice cream.
Yeah.
As a kid, I didn't quite understand it. Now that I'm a bit older, I get it.
Yeah. No, I agree. When I was little, that was not what I wanted to eat. No. But my dad loved pecan praline and butter pecan. Yeah. But
sorry. So what's the cookie itself before we get to the nuts and the glaze and everything on top? But what was the basic philosophy for the cookie itself?
Well, the overall flavor profile was like I wanted someone to take a bite of this cookie and think, wow, this tastes like butter pecan ice cream. Mm. And so the way that I did that is the actual cookie dough is pretty much a straight up shortbread butter cookie. But what I did is I caramelized and made like a praline out of the pecans. So you toss the pecans in maple syrup, put them in the oven, bake them, they caramelize. So it's basically like a brittle. You take half of them, pulverize them, and make your cookie dough. So you've got like...
So they're in the dough itself.
They're in the dough. But they're like pretty finely ground.
Yeah, yeah.
So
they're imparting flavor, but you don't really notice.
There's not really a texture. It's just adding to the crumbliness of the cookie. And then the other half get used on top for garnish. And then the glaze is just a milk and powdered sugar. So you get a little bit of the dairy notes. So that helps you get that kind of ice creamy flavor. And then because it's the holidays, you know, we threw some glitter and some sparkles on top.
Which kind of gives you just like it's like fresh snow.
It's like snow. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Wow, you're getting me in the mood for the holidays, Rick Martinez. Before we let you go, where will you be this holiday season?
So actually, I'm going to be in Mexico City.
Ooh, nice.
Yeah,
like
so
74. Perfect.
Yeah, and actually, my dad's coming down.
Oh,
so,
nice.
Yeah, I'm really excited. I bought a car, so he and I are going to drive around Mexico in the center. All the monarchs migrate south into Mexico, and there's a forest south of Mexico City where all the monarchs hang out. And so we're going to go down there and
get monarch tattoos.
Yeah, exactly.
This sounds like a buddy movie. All right, Rick Martinez, this is awesome. You can find Rick's beautiful and delicious cookie recipes in the December issue of Bon Appetit on stands now. Thanks, Rick.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Delaney, I feel like this is a seasonally appropriate day to record a Winter Drinks podcast.
It is gloomy outside.
It was like 30-something degrees and rainy this morning. It was like, it's been like the same level of darkness from 8 a.m. till 4 p.m.
No, day never showed up.
No, just didn't come. So, feels like a good time to start drinking.
Yeah, what, it's 4 o'clock?
Yeah. But
we're good.
It could be. The sun never came out. So, what are we drinking?
Okay, we're going to do 3 cocktails, all winter... in some sort of way. So maybe we're talking like a New Year's Eve type vibe. Maybe we're talking just your Tuesday night, December. I had a terrible day at work cocktail.
Yep,
maybe
know those.
Yeah, very familiar with that. And then maybe something that's just like a little, you know, a change of pace.
Okay, first question.
Yeah.
When you think of a wintry cocktail, what do you think of compared to when you think of like a summery cocktail?
Sure. I think one of the ultimate drinking myths is that cocktails have to fall into a season. There is a seasonality to cocktails. Sometimes that's true. For the most of the time, I don't subscribe to that belief at all. To me, a winter cocktail could be a bunch of different things. It could be something that's super bright and citrusy and clean and makes me forget that I'm sitting in this rain, right? That it's not cold. It could be something that... Oh, Adam's already questioning.
That's like, oh yeah, I'm gonna go have a Mai Tai and pretend it's
not like that. Not like
well,
that.
Then what is it like?
Like say a martini with a lemon twist. To me, that's
okay.
Clean, crisp, little bit of citrus. Like that brings me right out of the.
Maybe you've got a tuxedo on, and
maybe you have a tuxedo on, or it could be something that does just play into it. It's like, hey, you know what? the weather's dark out there. I need something that's really going to warm me up. I'm going to lay into the whiskey. I'm going to lay into rum. I'm going to lay into like spirits with a deeper, darker flavor.
That's what I was getting at. Do you find yourselves as a man of drink partaking more in the darker spirits in the wintertime than in the summertime?
Absolutely in the wintertime, But in the wintertime, I'd say I probably straddle the line pretty 50-50 in terms of darker cocktail versus lighter cocktail.
All right, what's up first?
So first is like the...
Can I have a potato chip as we're talking?
Oh, please, by all means. They will make all of these better.
So I need something salty.
Okay, so first up, I think we ran this recipe in maybe like, I want to say maybe 2015.
Okay.
And it's a play on a really classic cocktail formula, and I think we just ran it calling it the champagne cocktail.
Hmm. Okay.
And essentially it's a mixture of bubbly wine, bitters, lemon, like kind of pulverized lemon, and sugar, and that's it. It's like the easiest party cocktail
you could
ever make.
All right, let's see what you got. All right, so you're opening. What are you opening now?
I'm opening. So this is not a cocktail you want to make with like your, you know, birth year bottle of champagne,
no.
Right? You're not mixing the best champagne.
You're not breaking out the Dom for this.
No, this is just a bottle of like $14 Prosecco.
Okay.
So it's nothing of note.
I love $14 Prosecco.
That
is my go zone all holiday long. That on ice.
Four cocktails.
Yeah,
unbeatable. Also, yeah, straight up on ice, go for it. Maybe even a little lemon twist in there. All right.
Sunday morning with a little splash OJ.
A little splash OJ.
Oh my God, that sounds so good.
That is a good sound.
Like the vapors releasing.
That's seasonal just there.
Yeah. Okay. So what's the order? I would never know what.
So
I'd be worried I'm doing the wrong order.
So essentially, when you make this cocktail, it's just one thing going into another thing. The first thing you do is you take, basically you make this for one bottle. The serving size is one bottle of Prosecco. So you take one lemon, really thinly sliced, like you can see here.
Slice across in little rounds.
Across into rounds. You want to keep the entire circle there. And you want to, you know, like less or close to an eighth of an inch. Like, you don't want it to be a wide round of lemon.
Gotcha. And you have these now in a big four-cup Pyrex measuring cup thing.
Totally. So you want to throw them all in there, and then you add a teaspoon of bitters. You can use for this, like, probably more traditional to use Angostura, which is an orange-based bitter.
That everyone should have in
exactly.
their bar.
I used Peychaud's today, so, like,
another classic.
It's another classic. It's similar in flavor profile. So you muddle them all up until the sugar dissolves.
How much sugar?
So you're using four sugar cubes. I did not know this. One sugar cube is one teaspoon of sugar. So you could either do four teaspoons or four sugar cubes.
Four teaspoons, and you're using a wooden spoon and just mushing it all together.
Just mushing it all up. If you have like a mortar and pestle situation, you could do this in there if it's a lightweight one.
If you're at Andy Baragani's apartment, you have 12 mortar and pestles to choose from, that is like holiday. See, you should have a holiday party. Can we talk to Baragani? I bet that would be a fun party to go to, right?
Oh, he had a birthday party recently.
I wasn't invited to that. I was having my own birthday party that I didn't invite him to.
That's okay. So maybe it was a retaliation.
He could have at least invited the boss to his.
He could have.
I'm going to text him right now.
I'm sorry, Andy. Okay, so you're basically muddling up these lemons until they release all of the juice, and you want the rind to be kind of soft, not like totally crumbling apart, but soft. And then you take a few of the slices, and we're doing this in just like a stemless wine glass. You can serve this in literally whatever you want.
This would not make sense like in a champagne flute because the flute would be too narrow.
Exactly. So I do like three of the little slices in one glass, and then you just want to drain a bit of the lemon juice and dissolved sugar.
And it has like a nice sort of Campari orange.
Because of the Peychaud's. Yeah. Peychaud's is a red bitter, so it's going to give it that color for sure.
Would you ever? All right, you're pouring it. Oh, Alex is pouring the Prosecco right now. You just handed this to me.
Yeah,
we're going to not serve it on ice.
You could, if you wanted to. We do not say that because in an ideal world, you're pulling this bottle out of an ice bucket and it's totally cold and
Can I ask you this? Thank you. It looks beautiful. Would you ever just pour the entire bottle into a pitcher where you've mashed up the lemon, the bitters,
and then
pour it from there?
But I would only do that if you were going to pour it all
right away. Yeah.
You don't want it to sit outside of the bottle.
Oh, Emma, this is really good. because I love sometimes Prosecco on its own can be it just balances it out nicely with the bitterness of,
and the sweetness.
But the bitterness of the bitters. I never realized they're called bitters. the lemon, which brings the sour, but also that bit of rind,
yes,
which has that edge to it.
And a little bit of like fruity oil to it.
And the sugar is a little bit, but not like, oh my God, that's really sweet.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a very balanced, for being such a simple, like everyone has these ingredients kind of cocktail. It's very balanced.
I like this. Yeah. This is so much more fun than just a glass of Prosecco on its own.
Exactly. And the reason that I make this cocktail a lot is because...
Going to have some more potato chips.
Please, by all means, by all means. I'm kind of upset I didn't get a bag of potato chips. Now.
They're free in the kitchenette.
Okay, Emma, I'll be right back. No. The reason I make this all the time is because, like, someone always... Like, when you ask someone to bring wine, right, they're the people that bring the wine that you want to drink, and then someone will always end up with, like, a $12 bottle of Cava or Prosecco, and it sits in my fridge, and I'm like, oh, I know exactly what I'm going to use this for.
Also nice about this for a party situation... You've got the bitters in your little bar that is there forever.
Yeah.
You always have sugar. You always have lemons.
Yeah.
Super easy to make.
Yeah. You don't need to run like 10 minutes before the party starts. You're like, oh shit, I forgot no.
All right. I'm adding this to my repertoire. You're one for one, Delaney.
Hell yes. All right. So next up, we're going to move into no wine, more booze. So this is a cocktail that I call a filler-less cocktail. And a filler-less cocktail is a cocktail that only uses... liquor or some kind of aperitivo amaro in it. There's no juice, there's no seltzer, there's no wine.
Booze. Sounds dangerous.
And that's the classification of the cocktail I want to drink in the winter is it's filled with booze.
I mean, that's a Negroni, essentially.
And that's a great segue. Both the next cocktail is actually a riff on a Negroni. And the last time we did this pod, I did a Boulevardier, which is also a riff on a Negroni. Yep. This is called a white Negroni. So... it is a three-ingredient cocktail.
You have like all manner of measuring cups
everything was dirty. Everything was dirty in the test kitchen. This is the ultimate mismatch of
these are. You have those OXO ones where it's like the flying saucer at an angle around the pitcher.
I feel like right now I look like kind of a Howard Hughes situation. Yeah. All these weird liquids in jars.
All right, so what are we making?
All right, so we're gonna make a white Negroni.
Okay,
and a white Negroni, as the name would lead you to believe, is basically clear.
Yep.
You're not using Campari. You're not using sweet vermouth. You are still using gin. Hmm. So it's going to be 1.5 ounces of gin, 1.5 ounces of sweet vermouth. So you could use Lillet. You could use Cochi Americano.
Wait, dry vermouth or sweet vermouth?
Sorry, dry vermouth. Yeah, dry vermouth. And then you're going to use 1/2 ounce of Suze. So Suze is... a French aperitif.
This is one of those bottles I see everywhere, and I'm like, I've never bought that. I've probably never drunk it, but I know the label by heart.
Yes, and it's a beautiful label. It has that like cool big S on it.
Yeah.
Suze is kind of like a light Amaro. It's made with gentian root, which is the base of most Italian like famous Amari.
So it's taken the place of the Campari in what would
exactly.
be regular,
it's bringing,
traditional.
It's bringing bitterness, and it's bringing like a floral aspect.
But in a typical... Negroni, the ratios are usually 1:1:1:1.
Yeah. So the thing about Suze is that it packs a lot more flavor than Campari, even though it looks lighter. Campari's, it's kind of like listening to one guy playing a guitar is Campari and listening to an entire orchestra is Suze, right?
I don't know if I would make the guitar to orchestra comparison. Is like one guy playing guitar compared to like Led Zeppelin or something, like a whole band.
Okay. Yeah. That's fair. Okay, yeah. So we have Jimmy Page. We have Robert Plant.
Also, John Bonham's in there.
There you go.
John Paul Jones. Well, that sounds nice.
Yeah.
Okay. They're playing Immigrant Song or something. Okay.
This is the cocktail version
of
Immigrant
Song. Emma, if we start singing a Zeppelin song, do we have to pay for it? Or only if it's actually...
Emma, shut that down. No, you're not going to stop until
okay, so you have ice. You're pouring in the gin.
We're doing a double. Double.
Oh, I actually have a good thought. Question.
Sure.
You said the gin. You just did the dry vermouth. Do you have making a regular traditional Campari?
Sure.
What are your thoughts on the best types of gin to use? Because gin can vary widely in its botanicals, etc.
For sure. I am, and people will. Different bartenders will give you different answers. I think it's a two-part answer. One, if you want a blanket statement, say you want London-style dry gin.
Okay.
Like you want something that is very sharp and confident in its flavor. There's not a million different things going on. It's juniper.
Cool.
It's a little bit bitter. It's a little bit floral. That's it. But then the second answer to that question is it really depends on what else you're using. There are, if you want to get super nerdy and you want to use gin and vermouth and Amaro that's all made in your immediate area, and they're all going to be like these crazy different flavors.
Yeah, we're not going to
do that. We're not doing that.
All right, so basically straight up dry gin.
Yeah.
What you have in your pitcher literally looks like Mountain Dew right now.
It is. It's actually just, this is how you make homemade Mountain Dew.
There is a very Day-Glo green quality to it, or Day-Glo yellow at least.
Day-Glo yellow. Yeah, it's like a Mountain Dew Gatorade situation. Yeah, but always, again, and this is like bartending 101, I feel like. If it's just liquor, if there's no fresh juice, always stir.
Always stir. You don't, so when you shake, you want to agitate the juice and the liquor together to sort of emulsify
You're
them?
You're basically emulsifying the cocktail, yeah. Anything else, you just need to stir. Unless...
So like a margarita, for instance.
Correct.
Okay.
Because you have that fresh lime juice.
Yeah.
Unless it's like part of the style of the drink, like a shaken Negroni is a drink and it's a totally different mouthfeel, just aerates it kind of, and it makes it
My
lighter.
Wife, who will partake in a vodka martini now and then, she likes the martini shaken, which I know is not traditional, but she actually likes those little chips of ice that end up sort of floating on the surface.
I actually like them, too.
It's kind of a cool little thing.
It's a cool little thing.
Not as clean and this and that, but it's a thing.
It's a thing.
Okay, so in this one, you're including the ice with a lemon peel.
Lemon peel.
Rind peel.
You know what's funny? I was having this debate. Someone called this lemon zest, and if you're cooking, you would call it lemon zest. But someone called this lemon zest, and I looked it up, and people call that the zest of the lemon. Like the zest.
What do you mean in bartender speak? Or
yeah, yeah. No. Which is nothing. Something I would never in a
you
million
not
years
be friends with those people.
No. Okay, so yeah, like this has a very weird color to it for sure. Hmm.
Okay. It's interesting. It's less assertive smelling than a Negroni.
Yeah. Definitely on the more chill side. It's definitely bitter.
Okay, this is not for me.
It's not you?
Wait. Oh. It does not taste like Mountain Dew.
No, it doesn't.
See, this is interesting because this one, I find Negronis too sweet because of the sweet vermouth and the guar.
Sure.
This is like the opposite. I would like a little something to sort of take that sort of herbal edge off.
This is like herbal to the max.
Yeah.
But this is also the kind of thing that I love during the winter. Like, again, if I'm going to be sitting around eating like comforty, wintry food, if I'm eating a braised whatever, like this cocktail.
You're insane.
I am not insane.
Like braised short ribs? And, you know, all right. If I ever make it over to the Delaney house to watch your Eagles lose, I'm not having that to drink. All right.
Fair.
Third cocktail. But thank you for making it.
Oh, yeah, you're welcome.
Look cool.
Okay, we're emptying this out real quick. Okay, so third cocktail is another kind of deviation on a classic. And
did we invent that drink last time?
What drink?
The deviation.
Oh, we didn't, no.
I think we should name something. Let's come up with a drink and call it the deviation. Yeah.
Okay, by the end of the week.
Don't tell anyone. We better do it before this podcast comes out. So hurry up.
I'll do it tonight.
All right.
Okay, so this is another deviation. Not on a Negroni, but on really the first famous cocktail, the Manhattan.
Mm.
Late 1800s, invented at the Manhattan. It's a very simple cocktail.
Did you say like at the Manhattan, like the island of Manhattan?
No, an actual place called the Manhattan. A place called the Manhattan.
Is it in Manhattan?
Yes. The Manhattan is a super simple cocktail. It's rye, it's sweet vermouth, and it's bitters. There you go.
So what is the key to making a good one? Is it the balance? Is it the stirring? Like, that's what I don't understand about these super simple cocktails. Why is one better? Oh, this place makes the best martinis. And I'm like, well, what does that mean?
Sure. I mean, I think, one, it's about what you choose to include, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, whatever Joe Schmo bar you go to and a dive bar and you're like, hey, can I have a Manhattan? They're not going to probably pour you the whiskey they think is best.
You should be pretty particular about which whiskey.
Totally. And for me, it's always, we've kind of fallen into a tendency in broad strokes to make Manhattans with bourbon. Mm-hmm. And I think they're actually a lot better with rye. They were originally made with rye. It just brings a spicier, more interesting flavor. Bourbon leans sweet.
Yep.
Rye leans spicy.
So next time, say, I would like a rye Manhattan.
I would like a rye Manhattan.
Do you do yours up or on the rocks?
I do mine up.
Okay.
But, you know, no judgment. The rye that we're going to use is, I forget what I even poured. Oh, High West. High West Double Rye. So it's a blended rye from Utah.
I've actually had that in Utah before.
Oh yeah, wait, you you ski out there, right?
I've been out there.
I've been.
Do you know what the manufacturer suggested retail price is for High West? Is it like middle of the road, or is it?
I would say High West is middle of the road. It's the kind of bottle that I would buy if I was having a party and I was like, okay, I'm going to make some Manhattans for
people.
You
want to make something nice, but not too nice.
Exactly. I'm not going to go out and, you know, spend 95 bucks on a bottle of rye. Maybe I'd go out and spend 45.
All right, so you just added the rye?
The rye. So it's 2 ounces of rye per drink.
And per drink. Okay, so you're doing four
ounces.
Yeah,
so we're doubled. Yeah, so that's 4 ounces of rye. And then instead of sweet vermouth, we're going to go with Averna. Mm. And Averna is a Sicilian Amaro that we've talked about before.
So then how would you differentiate Averna from sweet vermouth?
So sweet vermouth is going to lean, I mean, at its core, it's different because vermouth is a wine-based liqueur, right? So it's always going to bring a super fruity flavor to it, and it's always going to lean more on like a green vegetal side. Averna is a, you know, a liquor-based, it's a distillate-based Amaro, and then it's also a lot deeper in flavor. So with a vermouth, you're kind of floating near the surface. With Averna or Amaro, you're going to go deeper. You're going to get crazier root and bark.
Rootsy, herbal.
Exactly.
If you haven't had before, you've had Jaeger before, then you kind of know where you're going with this.
Exactly.
So right now, you're just, that's just Averna, Amaro, and rye.
Yes.
Nothing
else? Nothing else. And then we're going to just finish it with a little bit of bitters.
Oh. Well, when do the bitters go in? After you pour it?
Yeah.
Oh, look at that, Emma. You ever done that before? No. She's like, nope.
Again, also in the winter, it's like when I want a cocktail in the winter, I want something that's going to like hit me and I don't have to do all this crazy kind of stuff.
Are you drinking this in the beginning of the night or more late night?
I like this for a nightcap.
So kind of a digestive.
Yes.
Digestivos.
And I also like, I will say, I like this because I can have one of these and then I can finish my night with just a glass of Averna. And that's
So now you're doing a couple of dashes.
Yeah, two dashes.
This is Peychaud.
This is Peychaud.
Which has a nice, like, almost the color of grenadine.
Yeah, grenadine or Campari.
Yeah. Does this have a name?
Yeah, this is called the Black Manhattan.
Okay, yes. I knew that, actually. Weirdly, I knew that. All right, so right now we're not doing it with ice.
We're not.
What would you typically serve this in?
I would serve this in a coupe if I was serving it up. If I was serving it with ice, I would serve it in a rocks glass.
Next question. Final question before we go. Then in terms of what would you accessorize this with?
I would do a Luxardo cherry.
Ooh,
the test kitchen was out of Luxardos.
Oh.
And maraschino. There were zero cherries in the test kitchen.
Would you ever do an orange zest?
You can do an orange peel orange zest, yes.
Woo! Actually, it's fascinating how much the Averna smooths it out.
At first, you're like, oh shit, rye. Yeah. And then it's like, oh no, wait. That's nice.
Really smooth. Yeah, it starts off hot and then smooths out after that.
Yeah. And with an orange peel or with a cherry, it'll bring a little more sweetness to it and round it out a little more.
Alex Liney, thanks for coming by. Thanks for the cocktails. Thanks for all your serving vessels.
Thank you. I'll bring these back down to the test kitchen.
Hi, this is Alex Beggs, and here's Cook, Marry, Kill. Cook. I've been busy lately. Writing stuff, buying endless Christmas presents, buying endless wrapping paper for those presents, running out of tape, going to fancy tea parties with powerful women. I did some laundry. Very busy. And that's how I found myself having popcorn for dinner twice in the past week. But not just any popcorn, rosemary garlic popcorn. Here's how I make it. In a Dutch oven, put some vegetable oil and 3 popcorn kernels over medium-high heat. Bob's Red Mill sent me some of their white popcorn, and I was like, ooh, free popcorn, but now I'm obsessed with it. It has a corny sweet flavor that blows my mind every time. Anyway, while that's heating up, put 3-ish tablespoons of butter in a saucepan with a sprig or two of rosemary and as many smashed garlic cloves as you can stand. When the first kernels start popping, add a 1/2 cup more into the pot and cover. Check on your butter, stir it around. Shake the popcorn pot like you know what you're doing. Stir butter again, shake popcorn again. At some point, the butter will be brown, the popcorn will stop popping, and you'll combine them in the biggest bowl you have, the one your dad has referred to as the bedpan. A meticulous person might take the rosemary sprig and garlic out, but a busy person might salt the hell out of the whole thing and get on with the show. Good luck out there. Mary. I want to figuratively marry the prankster who ate the $120,000 banana at Art Basel this week. The sculpture, I guess, by Maurizio Catalan was a banana duct taped to the wall and was titled Comedian. Get it? Bananas, banana peels, comedy, but it's stuck on a wall. Like comedy, it rots easily. My other artistic interpretations aren't podcast appropriate. Anyway, so three buyers bought versions of the piece. I repeat, $120,000 banana. So a professional prankster named David DeTuna, who looks like an economics professor or something, walks into the gallery in Miami, peels it off the wall, and eats it. But it's all good. The gallery and the artist aren't pressing charges. They seem to love it, but it does make you start wondering who's the artist here and who's the prankster. Kill. Ugh, I want to kill the stunty holiday KFC fire log. This is a scented log that makes your cozy living room smell like a bucket of fried chicken for 3 hours. You know what else would do that? An actual bucket of chicken, which you can eat. One review says, "The KFC fire log was a great addition to my house, made my room smell finger-licking good. My friend, have you considered the casual art of cooking? Popcorn counts. This log is like a vanilla cupcake scented candle. Why do people like these? It just makes you hungry. I consider that torture. And yet, it's sold out already. So is the Taco Bell Crunchwrap Supreme wrapping paper. Kill me."
The Bon Appetit Foodcast is produced and edited by Emma Wertzman, with additional programming help from Carrie Polis and Elise Inamine. Our theme music is by Nathaniel Wertzman. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to reach out to us about this episode or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.